to Senate Finance, first meeting of the year. It is Thursday, January 23rd. We're going to have an overview this morning presented by Angela Rodell for revenue, and then Management and Budget Director Karen Rayfield will be up to talk about the, give us some overviews. Before I do that, James, do we have that? I'll get back with that later. I don't really have a lot to say. I mean, let's just get on it, and we only have 90 days, so if you want to come on up and make the presentations, we do have present at the table Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Huffman, Senator Meyer, and myself. Senator Kelly Donnie Olson. Senator Donnie Olson had a personal tragedy in his family and is not in attendance today. We anticipate that he'll be back next week. Other than that, we'll take care of a few little things of housekeeping as we go along, but for now, let's get with Ms. Rodell. You have the microphone. Let's hear the revenue forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. I have two presentations for you today. One is on the state of the savings account, and the second is on the revenue forecast. I wasn't sure what your preference was as to which one you wanted to do first, or
let's do the revenue forecast and then the savings account.
All right. So. So getting started on slide three, what we wanted to do here was to give the committee a sense of where we actually turned out in fiscal years 2012 and 2013 compared to the forecast you have before you. So you can see that we've seen oil prices trend down over the last 2 years, over the last two fiscal years. We've seen the production decline from 579,000 barrels in 2012, fiscal year 2012, to 531,000 in fiscal year 13. We're looking at a forecast production of 508,000 for fiscal year 14. Lease expenditures in those 2 years were approximately $4.4 billion and $4.9 billion, so we saw a slight increase between 2012 and 2013. More notably, we're seeing a significant increase in lease expenditures for fiscal year 14 and 15, and I will get into more detail about those lease expenditures further on in the presentation. But just to see certain trends from the last two fiscal years compared to what we're looking at for the current fiscal year that we're in, along with fiscal year 15. Therefore, we've seen general fund unrestricted revenues decline. So in 2012, we had unrestricted general fund revenues of $9.4 billion. That has dropped in fiscal year 13 to approximately $6.9 billion, and we're seeing a further decrease in general fund revenue to $4.9 billion. And that is forecasted to stay right around the $4.95 billion mark throughout the next 10 years. I also wanted to give you a sense, because this is a question that we get asked periodically as to what the taxable value is for the production tax. So in 2012, we actually had a production tax value of $79.33. That declined in 2013 to $67.76, and that declined even further for fiscal year 14 to $54.67. And that's really due to four different reasons.
Mr. Chairman,
question.
Any questions on this page?
Go ahead.
Last year at this table, the department came forward and said that the department had been too optimistic in predicting the oil prices, and that was good news because in prior years, those were always overinflated, and it seems to me that practice is no longer in place because the prices through 2022 going up to $133 a barrel seems optimistic, especially when the United States is becoming energy independent and we're finding more and more energy in the U.S. So I wonder, has that policy changed, or do you feel that these optimistic numbers are achievable?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think you raised a really good question, and I am going to talk about it a little bit further. But to answer your question, I have more confidence in the next couple of years, so like through 2017, and part of that is because of the information that we have both globally and internally to look at our price forecast in the near term. What we have done in the past and continue to do in the later years is to use inflation. And so what you're seeing is the trend up due to inflation. Is it overly optimistic? Quite possibly. But I think if we look at the near term, 14, 15, 16, 17, I think we have much greater confidence in that. And that's been borne out when we look historically at what price forecasts have been versus what we actually came in at. And we have seen over the last 10 years that our price forecast tends to be more conservative than what has actually happened.
And the second question, Mr. Chairman, is on the ANS production. We see that continue to decline all the way through 2022 to 340 million barrels a day. And the question that I have is that with the passage of 21, when do you see that turning around and at least stabilizing? Do you have any idea when the 20? I know it's very difficult because the oil companies are the ones that are making the investments and doing the work, but that can be said for any of these years here. But when do you think that the production will at least stabilize?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think we're looking at some stabilization in the 2017-2018 because we're seeing a ramp up in activity, and it's going to take a while for those barrels, then subsequent barrels, to come online. I'd also like to remind the committee that we, in starting in with the revenue forecast in 2012, we changed the methodology on our production forecast because when we looked historically at it, we felt that it had been overly optimistic for many years. And so we looked at what we knew and the information we had. And so we took great pains, given the significance this has on the operations of the state, to decrease the error rate. And so if you'll recall, we adjusted the methodology. So we are more conservative in our estimate, and I've got a few slides later on in the presentation that go into what the potential differences in the production could be as a result of production coming online sooner rather than later.
And thank you, Mr. Rodell, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know what? Can you go to that right now, because we're on that topic?
Sure.
Can you just go to that, and let's see what your other predictions are.
Let me find
I hate to get you off off script, but this is an important question.
Absolutely. So if we start on slide 12, we wanted to give a sense of the of how we come up with the production forecast. And historically, and where that production is coming from. And historically, Prudhoe Bay has always been the center of production for the state. And one of the things that you'll note is if you look at 2000, I think it's roughly 2000-2001, when new fields came online and started producing oil, you saw a leveling out of the production that came in on a daily basis, and that's the same sort of thing that we are looking to have happen here. I think the other takeaway from this chart is just how much production is not Prudhoe Bay now, and forecasting for non-Prudhoe Bay production and all the different fields. So I think that is of great value to Alaska and Alaskans to see that additional activity outside of Prudhoe Bay. Alpine, Kuparuk have been very important to the future production forecasts of the state. So looking at past, just to give you a sense of why we made the changes in 2012, if you look at past forecasts, and here we've included the fall 2005, 7, 9, 11 forecasts, 2005, we were showing for fiscal year 2013 in excess of 800,000 barrels a day. And in fact, we are much closer to the 500,000 barrels a day. So the forecasts did not provide as accurate as information. Even as recently as fall 2011, we were significantly overstating the amount of production versus what actually what we know to be true in fiscal year 13. So we imposed a process of assessing production. And if you remember in the past, we had three categories of oil production. We had currently producing, which is what we know to be coming out of wells based on investments and information that we're getting from the companies themselves. We had under development, which was oil from projects that were existing or new fields that we knew to be worked on. And we also had under evaluation, which were projects that were likely to occur in the future. There's exploration happening. Those two last categories, under development and under evaluation, we combined into one category now called new oil. So what we take now is we continue to have the currently producing, and that's really the bulk of the production forecast. This is actual production data that we know about. This is oil coming through the pipe, and we have great confidence that this that these barrels will be produced. The new oil portion has now been adjusted for uncertainty in subsurface conditions, delays, et cetera, and we're not taking it as 100% that it will happen. So it takes into account the uncertainty with these projects, and the farther out they are in the forecast, the more they are discounted. And our intention is that as we get closer to those wells and actually producing oil, that those barrels will then get added back into the production forecast when we have greater confidence that they're actually going to be produced. Excuse me. So in order to do this methodology, we took a look historically at what we have been doing. And here you can see the decline rates that happened annually starting in 2006. So we looked past the last 7 years. And it created mathematically this line of best fit, and that's the black dotted line you see. And that's sort of our starting point for a forecast going forward. We then take a look at what would happen if we had no new oil, and that's the bottom dotted line, gray dotted line. And then if we took our old methodology, which included everything the companies gave us, and assumed everything would happen exactly as they forecasted and wanted to happen. And that's the top gray dotted line, which is labeled no risk adjustment. And using our risk factoring, we have the black line, which is our forecast, which is along that line of best fit from our historical decline rate. So what that does is, and I think this is a more illustrative graph of what you saw on the previous page, which is to give a sense to the committee of what is currently producing and the decline of that, what new oil is from the legacy fields and will not be eligible for the more Alaska Production Act tax credits. So a significant portion of new oil will continue to come from the legacy fields. And then in the brown tan bar is what we have forecasted to be eligible for the More Alaska Production Act tax credits. And then that green area is the upside potential. And that's really what we see as production that would occur if everything happened exactly as forecast, or not as forecast, I'm sorry, but as the companies have stated, and that actual top line would have been what you would have seen as a production forecast if this were 2010 or 2011 under the old methodology. So you can see that there's great upside potential for production that we are no longer including because it is important that we maintain a conservative revenue forecast. And I just want to add that when we presented this, these changes both to the price and to the production forecast, we got a lot of really good feedback from external investors, rating agencies, Wall Street, who were very complimentary on how the state conservatively forecasts its revenue and then budgets within its means. So that really is the production forecast, and then I can move on to the price forecast details.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From 2018 to 2023, it seems as though we still are on a gradual decline, and I'm wondering, it was said that we were going to try to level off or bring turn around the curve mm-hmm. with 21. That was the mantra there. So my question is, when past 2023 do we level off and start increasing, adding, turning the curve around?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that's a really hard question for me to answer, quite honestly. I think that that is, we don't look that far into the future. That's plus 10, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And so I couldn't say with any certainty when that would happen.
Can you say if that will happen?
I can't say one way or the other if that will happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop, I know you have a question, but before you do, I want to have a brief at ease here. I just want to take about a 15-minute recess, and if everyone could just kind of stay in place, finance members, including Lyman, if you could huddle up with me for a few minutes.
Okay, we're back on the record, and we can go ahead and continue with your presentation. Ms. Rodell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to do, if possible, is I'd like to take a step back to the... We've moved around a little bit in an effort to answer some of the committee's questions, and I think what I'd like to do, if we could, is move back to the forecast itself and talk a little bit about all the components that go into the forecast, not just the production piece of it, so that we can talk about what we're seeing and what we're and what we're doing. So if I could take us back to slide, I believe it's back to slide 5. We'll start with slide 5. I think this is probably the easiest place for me to get started, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chairman. We talked previously about how oil price and production levels have been reduced, and price and production are two very important and probably the largest components to the revenue forecast. But they're also impacted largely by lease expenditures and by transportation tariffs. And we're seeing a substantial increase in spending on the North Slope over the next 10 years. Oil companies are projecting increased North Slope production following increased activity. And one of the things that I would like to remind the committee is that there are a number of potential oil production areas that we don't include in our forecast that we know are being worked on. For example, heavy oil. We don't have any provision for heavy oil, but we know a lot of work is being done on heavy oil. Shale is another area that there's a tremendous amount of activity around, but we do not include that in our production forecast at this time. And a lot of that has to do with what our role is with the revenue sources book, and that's to always give you a prudent forecast that you can use for budgeting purposes. And it's really important that we continue to maintain that conservative revenue forecasting methodology so that we don't get ahead of ourselves and create overly optimistic forecasts that then create future problems for the state. The other thing that I will be really, quite honestly, very excited to go through with you is the state savings accounts and how our investment performance is doing, and our state investment earnings are very strong. And you're going to see some very different numbers from the revenue sources book on that front versus what you get presented in the savings accounts, because they've been updated through calendar year 2013. So if we look at just the general fund unrestricted oil revenues, there are basically four components of petroleum revenue that we forecast, and you'll see that royalty, corporate income tax, and property tax are all relatively stable, and production tax is where we're seeing the largest piece of decline. And with the net tax system, those lease expenditures are going to continue to have an effect in the near term on our production tax forecast. When we look at all the other revenues, we have some revenues, tax types, that are important to the state general fund. They're not as important as our petroleum revenues, but they still contribute significant amounts of revenue to the state. And this is what I mentioned on the investment numbers. You'll see the forecast of $86 million, roughly up 15% for fiscal year 14. That number is actually going to be closer to $100 million, given 3 months of additional earnings from when we set the forecast back in October, when we cut off for forecast purposes in October. Finally, when we look at the total revenue forecast for 14 and 15, we're looking at a total state revenue from fiscal year 13 actuals of $15.8 billion down to $12.8 billion, and then leveling off to $12.3 billion for fiscal year 15. One of the things that I know has always interested the committee is the price sensitivity of the forecast. And I think one of the things that you will see here is that we're seeing a lot less volatility in revenues due to changes in price. And one of the things that I would like to work with the committee on would be to also look at this from a production volatility or sensitivity, I guess would be a better word, as to what do changes in production do as well to GF unrestricted revenue. But I think we have a very a stabilized forecast here, and at $100 a barrel, we're at roughly $4 billion in unrestricted revenue. And if that goes up $10, we get an additional approximately $1 billion in revenue. And if it goes down, as price declines, we continue to generate significant revenue. We don't see as much effect on the volatility as prices decline. With this graphic, we wanted to give a picture of what's happened over the last 10 years and what we're seeing for the next 10 years. You'll see in 2004, we had actual production of roughly 974,000 barrels a day, and we are down, that's been cut in almost in half to 531,000 barrels. That decline rate stabilizes going forward. We believe it could, and we're looking at approximately around 500,000 barrels for the next two fiscal years. We've covered the production forecast methodology, so I won't go into that anymore with the committee unless the committee has additional questions on that. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about what we saw with the price forecast. And this gives you a sense of where we were when we did the fall 2012 forecast, what was happening in the world, along with what was happening in March and April when we released the spring forecast, and then where we are today. So there was a lot of activity happening globally that was disruptive to the global oil markets. The threat of Syria using chemical weapons in the summertime really drove up prices in oil production, and we were basically looking at going to war in Syria over that July-August timeframe. In October, we had a price forecasting session. Oil prices were on the way down because we avoided that, and there was talk of ending the embargoes with Iran, and so we were seeing the potential for additional supplies coming online. But we have stayed within the last I guess 18 months, 20 months between that $100 and $120 band for that time period. So there are two main factors when we look at oil prices that we monitor. Supply and demand has always influenced, so both potential spare capacity, and I alluded to that a little bit about what the effect of Iran now being allowed to export its oil, and then also the cost of developing new oil supply. We are working on developing a model which will incorporate that spare capacity and look at ways to account for price sensitivities and see if we can't be more accurate in our price forecasts as well. We think it's very important to continue to work on removing error rates out of our forecast and or diminish our error rates in the forecast so that you can truly rely on what the department delivers in that standpoint as you go forward.
Mr. Chairman, on that slide. Thank you. On that slide, Mr. Chairman, how does the fact that the United States will become moving more toward energy independence play out to the because of the lower transportation costs of foreign oil play on the price of Alaska North Slope pricing?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think we are going to see prices continue to stay, I'm not going to say low because I'm sure there are people around the table that remember $9 a barrel, but lower than what we have seen in recent years. There is some information that OPEC is very interested in keeping oil prices around $100 a barrel. So there's a school of thought that believes we have this natural floor at around $100 a barrel. I'm not sure I'm willing to buy into that just yet, but it's definitely going to have an impact, Senator Hoffman, on prices as we see. But and there are other factors as well, because one of the things that we're also seeing is that oil coming out of the Bakken Shale is high it's not clean oil, and so it's, you know, Enbridge announced recently that it was not going to accept any Bakken oil through its pipelines because of the effect it was having in corroding the pipes and the environmental effects. So I think as the cost of producing that oil increases because their transportation costs increase, that will also have a countering effect on just the sheer supply. So I think there are a number of factors that will be feeding into the oil price going forward, and it'll continue to be volatile.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Ms. Murphy.
As we have for a number of years now, we held a day-long oil price forecasting session on October 1st in Anchorage. We had a number of speakers to come and give us their insights into the oil markets, modeling financial aspects of the commodity markets. We had 39 participants. They came from revenue, from DNR, labor, budget participated, but we also get external participants from the University of Alaska. Legislative finance also participates, and we asked those participants to forecast real North Slope prices, and then we converted those using a 2.5% inflation assumption. Looking back at what happened in past years, is you can see what the average price was, the actual average price that was used that converted back to our revenue collection. So you will see in 2009, when we had global unrest, financial market, Great Recession, all of those factors, the average price was $68.34, but the band prices ranged from under $40 a barrel at one point to as high as $130-some a barrel. We're seeing those bands narrow as the global economy steadies to some degree. And so, for example, in 2013, you saw very little price volatility and the actual price of $107.57. So looking at changes, what happened from the spring forecast and the fall forecast? So as I said, when we went into the spring forecast, we were looking at potential wars with Syria and the Middle East unrest, and we had forecasted oil prices at $109 a barrel. Peace makes a big difference to the price of oil in the world, and we have had to reduce that. I think it's a significant change, reducing it almost $4 a barrel to $105.68. For fiscal year 15, we're maintaining we believe that there will be a relatively stable price environment, and we have a forecast of $105.06 for fiscal year 15. Going back to what I had said earlier about the four components that drive the revenue forecast. So we saw continued declines in production. We had a longer summer season, summer field season, spread over fewer barrels of oil than we had forecasted. And quite honestly, I think production declines were happening faster than we had anticipated. We saw the decline in the price also affect the revenue forecast. But we saw a significant increase in deductible lease expenditures of almost $450 million. Transportation costs also increased from $8.87 to $10.11, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that there were fewer barrels of oil to spread those transportation costs across. So the average production tax value per barrel was reduced by $9.23. When we look at the fiscal year 15 revenue forecast, we see some similar activity. So we've stabilized the production decline. We don't see a decline at the rate we saw for a year ago. We're seeing a similar price decline at $105.06. We're seeing, yet again, even more increase in lease expenditures of almost $1 billion. And we are seeing that continued increase in transportation costs. So we're not seeing transportation costs go down. And so all of that has affected the revenue in our production. Tax value per barrel from the fall to the from the spring to the fall was reduced by $14.90.
Senator Dunleavy,
just a quick question through the chair. The thousand, the plus 1,000 on the lease changes. What is the belief behind that? As to why that is.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's a very good question, and takes me to my next slide. So we're seeing a tremendous increase in activity and drilling in capital expenditure forecast, and this is something that I know members of the committee have been interested in the past. And you can see that in fiscal year 2014, we have about in actual, from the spring forecast to the fall forecast, an increase of 67. And then in 2015, you really see the bump up of 826. So in the deductible lease expenditures of $1 billion, you have CapEx comprised of about 826 million. And then the balance is the operating expenditures, which I have on the next slide. And that increased activity, this comes to back to the number I had told you earlier of approximately $10 billion. So approximately $9.4 billion in capital expenditures. We are being told by the companies in increased drilling, exploration, all the activities surrounded by putting on, there's been announcements by BP, all of that activity, which is really a positive indicator for potential new production. And as I stated earlier, it's really important to us that we don't take the company's word on the actual production, but wait to see what comes in and what we see coming online in the near term before we prudently add it back in, because it is so important to how we look at revenue and how we use the revenue forecast for financial management and budgeting purposes. So I think this is a very telling story as to what we're going to see. And I am hopeful, very hopeful, that this will you'll see this reflected in future production forecasts. On the second page, you see the difference from the operating expenditures.
Could I stop you just for a moment?
Yeah.
Could you back up, please?
Sure.
So this increase in expenditure or in capital expenses is not reflected in the current revenue forecasts going forward. Is that correct?
I just want to clarify, some of it is included, but not all of it is included.
What is it, how massive of an undertaking is it for you to supply to members what forecasts would look like with those included? Is that something you can do?
I think that's something that we can... We can work with the committee on putting together.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So what you see in on slide 29 is a significant increase in operating expenses versus the capital expenditures in 2014. So I think when I kind of wish I had these slides side by side so that you could see what's really going on here. So the companies are building up staff, gearing up engineers, and that's what you see in the OPEX change of $319 million in 2014. And then the capital expenditures start kicking in 2015. So that's why you see low CapEx in 2014, but the big bump in 2015, and vice versa here in 2014 to 2015 on operating expenses. So there's a lot of activity. There's a lot going on in both of these fronts. And that, quite honestly, Senator Kelly, concludes my presentation on the revenue forecast, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions you might have.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Hearing none, I want to just take a little time to recognize many of the staff members that are returning this year. A lot of familiar, and by the way, Angela, we appreciate it. And I'm just going to go around the room and try to, get everybody that helps to make our little finance family function more favorably. I could probably do better than that. Anyway, Allison over here. First of all, starting with James, which makes most of this work. And James Armstrong, I'm sure you all know him. Allison, over the top are Jesse and
Danae.
How do I struggle with that? Then, put my glasses on. I've got a little list here. Most of you I know, but Aaron Schein from Senator Fairclough's office, Mike Smith from Senator Bishop's office, Daryl behind the camera. Daryl, good to see you. You've been around here forever. Good guy. Stuart Ritchie?
Steve.
Oh, excuse me, Steve. With Senator Dunleavy's office, Gary Zepp with Senator Huggins' office, Brett Huber with Liesl McGuire's office, Senator McGuire. And Brett, how many years have you been around here?
First one was 94.
Really? Well, about the time I came in. Yeah. On this side, we've got Donnie down there who kind of runs the Donnie Gott is your last name? Tim Grusendorf with Senator Hoffman's office, Denise, help me out with this, Licioli, Bruce Campbell from my office, Christine and Suzanne from Senator Meyer's office, and Marta. And Marta, I know Marta came in when I came in back in 94, 95? I think she was a page then. Oh, 89. Anyway, we just appreciate all the work that you do, and it makes it not only makes our work easier, it makes our work possible, and we just very much appreciate all your help. Senator Meyer, you had a question for...
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think I've heard the governor mention that at $105 oil, that's about the crossover price between ACES and the new Senate Bill 21, More Production Act. And certainly, you know, the forecast for oil is downward as more oil is being produced, especially in the lower 48. As oil prices do continue to go down, certainly we do look much better under the new Senate Bill 21 than we would have under ACES. And certainly the projected increase in capital and operating expenses makes sense, because now the oil companies are announcing these new projects that are coming on as we pass the More Production Act, and certainly we passed the More Production Act to basically get more production, because there was already quite a bit of activity going on in the slope, but we were paying for that through the 20 cents on every dollar capital credits. So at least now we got the emphasis, I think, in the right place. It's on production. Do you still agree with the production forecast that 105 is the crossover point, or is that number changed?
Excuse me, Senator Meyer. Through the chair, in answer to your question, I do believe that that's still the crossover point. I don't have information. We're continuing to evaluate it, and we can provide you more detailed information on that after the committee hearing. But I believe that that is still correct.
And I, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I think You know, there's been more optimistic forecasts for production, especially, you know, we were referring to 10 years out there for a while. But a lot of that, I believe, had to do with potential offshore development. That, granted, that doesn't bring too much revenue into the state, but it does add oil to the pipeline. And mm-hmm. certainly what happens with the offshore stuff is anybody's guess right now, I think.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I think you raise a really good point, Senator Meyer, that there's, we know that there's a lot of opportunities for companies in Alaska on developing that we don't include in the production forecast. So I think that there's a lot that can happen here as companies continue to do their exploration work.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, and I think you addressed a lot of those. I mean, they're still experimenting with the heavy oil and the potential of that. And Great Bear, we haven't heard much from them, but at one time they were very bullish on oil shale up there. So, yeah, there is, I think, a lot of potential. Unfortunately, you can't include that because it's potential.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think that's correct. I think it's really important when we're doing the revenue sources book, as opposed to some of the other work that the department is tasked with, that we provide you with our best estimate of revenue, knowing exactly what we know today, and that we don't. We've gotten a lot of credit from investors. It's why it's one of the things that gets stated in the rating reports as to why we're a AAA rating. We take this very seriously, and we don't want to ever give the misperception that we're misleading or creating an environment in the near term that is unrealistic and then puts the state in worse financial problems, because so much relies, I mean, when we have 90% of our revenue dependent on one revenue source, the oil production tax, it's incumbent upon us to be as conservative and forthright in that forecast with you. But we see a lot of activity, we hear a lot of things from the companies, and so I am very optimistic that we will be coming and hopeful that we will be coming back with very different production forecasts in the future.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Meyer?
If I can just end on this optimism, because I share that optimism with you in the sense that right now oil companies won't explore for oil in Alaska because they're afraid they'll find gas, which is pretty natural. When you look for oil, you find gas, and vice versa. And right now, when you find gas, it's stranded. You can't get rid of it. So that makes Alaska at a disadvantage versus other countries and other states. So with the gas line prospect looking more encouraging, that's going to add to, you know, more production and more exploration.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I did have a presentation on the state savings accounts. If you'd like to still go through that, or
if everyone's had their questions answered on the revenue forecast. Ms. Rodell, please continue.
All right. So what I wanted to do with this presentation is to give you a sense of where we are today. These numbers are all as of December 31st, to give you a sense of what the performance has been. As many of you are well aware, the equity markets were very good to everyone who had investments in the equity markets in calendar year 2013. The Dow Jones Industrial was up over 25% for the year. So the state definitely realized the benefit of that through its equity investments. One of the things that I will want to continue to work with the committee on and talk to the committee about is looking forward in the information that we're getting out of the Federal Reserve. Chairman Yellen has continued they continue to talk about quantitative easing and not continuing that policy, and what happens if interest rates go up. And I have concerns, or I shouldn't say, I do have concerns, but I have staff looking deeply into what our asset allocations are and what our exposure is to the bond market, because as interest rates go up, our bond prices go down, and so the mark-to-market value of those investments will go down. And so what can we be doing, recognizing that we're going to need those reserves, recognizing what our time horizon is on the draws of those reserves, et cetera, and what we can do to mediate that. So starting with the general fund, and this is the fund that provides the day-to-day cash for operations of the state. This has a moderate risk profile with a short to intermediate investment horizon, and that really is because of the liquidity requirements of the state. So we have approximately 45% in short term, 45% in intermediate, which is under 3 years, it's 1 to 3 years, and then the liquidity fund, which is truly cash. And one of the things I want to point out here that you're going to see is you'll see that on December 31st, 2012, we had a balance in the general fund of almost $11.8 billion.
Can I break in just for a moment? Senator Huggins is here. Senator, would you like to take Senator Olson's seat? He's gone.
Thank you very much. I can see perfect. I got a bonded guy.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead, Ms. Rodell.
Sure. Continuing on, so you'll see that on December 31st, 2012, we had a balance of $11.8 billion, and on December 31st, 2013, we had a balance of $5.76 billion. I want to assure the committee that nothing happened to the difference. What we did is we took the statutory budget reserve out of the general fund and created its own asset allocation, so it is now invested independently from the general fund with its own asset allocation. So what you're seeing there is the withdrawal of the statutory budget reserve fund out of this fund. Fiscal year...
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
Senator Hoffman,
what was the justification for that?
The justification for that, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, was that we felt that that statutory budget reserve, given the size of the balances we had, needed to be allowed to invest in a slightly longer time horizon given what we expected the draws to be and the significant balance in that fund. So we had in excess almost $5.5 billion in the statutory budget reserve fund, and we had no and so it was important that we try to maximize what we can, knowing what the time horizon was for the use of those funds, that we be allowed to go out slightly longer than what the general fund was invested in, because it didn't have the same liquidity need that the general fund has.
But the question that I have is that it seems as though those are funds that are available, general funds that are available under the definition to be spent by the legislature, and it doesn't give a true, by excluding it, it doesn't give us a true picture of what the general fund balance is.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it's still here. It has its own page.
I understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Rodell.
Okay. And just so you can see the return, we beat the benchmark both for the fiscal year 2013 as well as year-to-date, we're slightly ahead of our benchmark. Looking at the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, we have it divided between the main fund and the subfund. The subfund was determined a few years ago to have a longer time horizon and take a more higher risk profile. This is where you're going to see the true benefit of the equity investments that the Constitutional Budget Reserve subfund makes. We increased the value of the subfund almost $700 million, $5.5 billion. It was up to $6.3 billion. On the other hand, on the main fund, the majority of the main fund is in treasury bills, intermediate bonds, and a small amount of it's all in bonds. And so you can see the effects of that. The fiscal year performance was slightly under the benchmark at 0.18% as interest rates have continued to slightly increase, especially in the treasury market. We're seeing losses of almost 0.25% year to date. Fiscal year to date, it ended up with a investment of 0.35%. The Power Cost Equalization Fund, in statute, we are required to target a 7% return rate. Therefore, there's a 80% allocation to equities. That was of great benefit over the last year. That fund increased from $787.5 million to $937.3 million at the end of December. We saw fiscal year return of 15.12%, ahead of our benchmark of 14%, and well ahead of the 7% that we had targeted. Year to date, we're already up 22.3%.
Mr. Chair. Senator Meyer.
A couple questions. First of all, on the previous slide, on the CBR, as you know, the governor has suggested withdrawing $3 billion from the CBR for cash infusion into the pension liability. Would that $3 billion come out of the main account or the sub-account? Because your sub-account's doing pretty good.
Through the Chair, Senator Meyer, I think there are two things, and when I get to the trust funds, you'll see it as well. The trust funds have an asset allocation that is different than the sub fund. So the sub fund did not perform as well as PERS and TERS by comparison. That's not to diminish what the sub fund did here. In answer to your question, though, I think what we would do is we would look at the investments that are in both the main and the sub. We would look at what the asset allocation is for PERS and TERS and the mark-to-market values, and move what we could and just move it over out of either, and then rebalance between the sub and the main. But I hesitate to say we would take it all out of the main or all out of the sub, because in reality it really wouldn't work that way. Because what we need to do is make sure that when we move that money, we don't want to have to liquidate and take potential losses, especially on the bond side of it, and move it over. So we want to do it as carefully as we can. And I think one of the things that the governor's proposal will do is really take money that's in these funds and really leverage it by putting it in the asset allocation of PERS and TERS.
I guess my follow-up question would be then on the PCE fund. That fund seems to have done substantially better than the other funds.
Through the Chair, Senator Meyer, and that really is because in statute we're required to achieve a 7%, and given what we knew, what we've known in the past as to how to optimize an asset allocation to achieve the 7%, we had to go 80% into equities, which one could argue was maybe too aggressive. And we benefited this year from it, quite honestly. But that's the tension that happens there, is that we have both the desire to keep principal and hold on to it, but a market that's slightly out of whack when you have a bond market that is so underperforming, and potential losses there as well because of rising interest rates. Equities sort of, if you talk to some individuals, equities are overperforming, they're overvalued, so they're looking for a correction in the stock market. So it's really, we work really hard to sort of balance these tensions between the two, to making sure we achieve what we can and meeting our statutory obligation, along with recognizing the importance of these funds to the state.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, a lot of credit for this PC fund goes to my colleague to my left, but I'm wondering if it's earning this much money, maybe the fund's too big, or no. And it's also my understanding that this is probably one of the first years where PC is going to be 100% covered by the interest or the returns from this fund. So it's working as intended. Mm-hmm.
Through the Chair, I think that's right, Senator Meyer. This is one of the first years where we won't be looking for general fund contributions, but that'll be for Alaska Energy Authority, I believe, carries that for us.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As members may recall, this was discussed last year during this same presentation, and the markets were considerably different, and we had seen a loss in the fund because of the markets and the higher required return of 7%. We were fortunate to have a robust market, as Ms. Rodell said, in excess of 25%, but that I don't believe will be attainable in the future. And this committee had discussed legislation to try to bring that required percentage down to 5 to 5.5%, and that is in the works, and I think we're going to be addressing it because this fund could just as easily at 7% requirement go back to 7 to 6 to potentially $500 million, and then it would be a drain on the fund. And members should look at this as it may have some high years, but it may have some low years, but it averages out. So we will be addressing the hopefully addressing the what I believe is too high of a requirement of an interest rate, and both the Senator Fairclough and I have discussed this at some length, and I know the chairman is well aware of that that situation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking for some pots of money for a capital budget.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to amplify what Senator Hoffman said, as far as our discussions have gone over this past year, and to point to what our acting commissioner has spoken to, the market is looking to readjust. And we're riding on top of the bubble now, as Senator Hoffman has said, to Alaska's benefit for this particular fund. But just like the other forecasts that we were looking at, there were fairly conservative. That's why we need to look at this. If we don't want to see that bandwidth adjustment of either losses or gains, and we want less risk to the state when our financial projections need the most management, we will need to address for this fund lowering the rate of return so that we don't force our investors to invest in more risky proposals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Rodell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Continuing on to the public school trust, this has an allocation 58% to the broad market, 27% domestic equity, and 15% international equity. So a lower allocation to the equity markets. This fund increased from just under $500 million to $536.7 million by the end of December 31st. It had an actual rate for the fiscal year 2013 of 8.19%. We're looking year to date at 10.59%. I think this is a good illustration between the two funds, the power cost equalization with an 80% allocation to equity versus the public school trust with an allocation of approximately 40% to equities, and what that can do and what can be achievable under current market conditions. Getting to the PERS and TERS trust funds, one of the things that PERS and TERS is allowed to do that we cannot do with the Constitutional Budget Reserve is have a much broader asset allocation and touch on more markets. So while we do have significant exposure to equities, domestic equity is approximately 26%, global equity around 25%, we also get to put money into real assets like timberland and farmland, alternatives, and absolute return or private equity. So you'll notice if you look at last year's presentation versus this year, you're going to see a slight increase in the amount of cash being held. This was done as a hedge against falling, rising interest rates, falling bond prices, and holding a little bit more in the form of cash. I think the strategy did well for the ARM board this year. We saw returns of in fiscal year 13 for PERS of 12.5% and TERS 12.59%. That's better than the Constitutional Budget Reserve subfund of 11.75%. And I think that comes from the alternatives that the PERS and TERS can invest in with its time horizon and the CBR. And then finally, with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, PERS and TERS did slightly better than the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and I think that that's due primarily to different long-term investment goals and the need to achieve different rates. So the permanent fund's goal is to achieve a real rate of return of 5%, and they exceeded that very well, and they continue to look for different opportunities and so that they are not overexposed in any one asset class. The balance on December 31st was $49.24 billion with the permanent fund. And that was a fiscal year 13 return of 10.9, and they're looking at a year-to-date of 12.27%. So they are doing very, very well. It's kind of nice, you'll notice on the five-year, I didn't point this out on every slide, but on the five-year actuals, we've had 2009 drop out. And so the returns are actually looking much better over the last 5 years. So 11% for the permanent fund on that. Looking at the fiscal year 2014 forecast, just to give you an idea as to sort of where we see the investments heading for the balance of the year, to update what you saw in the revenue sources book, we're looking at an increase in investments to investment income of over $100 million. In unrestricted general funds, and then on the restricted funds of approximately GF of $7.7 million. On the CBR, we're looking at $823 million. And then when we add in the other funds we manage in the Alaska Permanent Fund, a total restricted amount of $4.8 billion. So, as I said at the start, the markets have been very good to the state this past year, and that will be helpful in your discussions going forward. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would entertain any questions you might have.
Members, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think I'm a little confused here because you said the PERS and TERS fund is relying on an 8% return over a 30-year period, but yet we said on the PCE fund that 8% was unrealistic and that we should lower that down to 5.5, 6, 7%. What's the difference?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I think that's a really good question. On PCE, we have a statutory requirement to achieve 7% without regard to inflation, a real return rate of 7%. Given the uses of those funds, that's a very aggressive rate of return. That money gets used and is relied on every year. PERS and TERS has a different time horizon. We assume 8%, including an inflation factor in that 8%. So we need a real return of something slightly less than 8% in order to achieve. And that's what the actuary is using to value the funds, what's going to be available for benefits over the course of 30 years. So it's a very different time horizon that we have, and yet we're using a very similar target rate of return.
Okay, so if I may, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to get too far into the pension liability and how we're going to deal with that, but if that $3 billion cash infusion didn't earn 8%, then that $500 million each year that the governor is suggesting we would have to make, we could potentially go up if we don't make that 8%. Is that?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. Yes, with a caveat. So, our goal with the $500 million is to keep it at $500 million, and we're going to be looking. So you're going to see the liability adjust and float around depending on the investment returns. And so there could be years if we have, you know, a year like 2009 where we lost 20%, you'll see the liability go up.
then you'll see, when we have a year like we did last year, you'll see the liability come down. So you'll see the liability move around, but I think the intention with the governor's proposal is to create some budget certainty going forward, and I know Ms. Rafel will be talking about this more later today in front of the committee, but is to create that budget certainty for the next, for the foregoing future. And that $3 billion, yes, it could potentially lose, but I think the opportunity for it to gain and the leverage that we can use by putting it in today, investing it in the PERS and TERS asset allocation, will really leverage those dollars over the 30-year time horizon compared to what we would do if we had if we left it where it is today.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Any other questions? Was that your presentation then?
That is my presentation, Senator Kelly.
Thank you. We appreciate it. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
We'll take just a little bit of at an ease as you guys switch out, and we'll hear from Ms. Rayfield from the Management and Budget Office.
Welcome back. We're going to have a little bit of a shift in our focus, and I'll give us just a moment to get reorganized here.
You got my pen.
Welcome back. And we're going to take a little shift here to go to our overviews with Ms. Rayfield from the Office of Management and Budget and John Boucher, and enlighten us.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Karen Rayfield. I'm the Director of the Office of Management and Budget. With me this morning is John Boucher, our senior economist. I believe you're all very familiar with Mr. Boucher. In the audience, I have our chief budget analyst, Kelly O'Sullivan, and I think many of you know Kelly as well. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to talk with you about the governor's budget proposed for fiscal year 2015. There are three budget bills that have been read across for the operating capital and mental health bills. You have Senate Bill 119 is the capital budget, Senate Bill 120 is operating, and Senate Bill 121 is the comprehensive mental health operating and capital budget bills. I'd like to start by thanking all of you and your staff and your subcommittees and their staff for the time and effort that I know you're going to take to go through these budget bills, and I know how much work it is. Also like to thank Mr. Teal and his staff for the work that they do reviewing our proposal and preparing the documents that you use in your process. It's very helpful to all of us as well. So I appreciate all of that, and I'd like to just get started, Mr. Chairman, and of course we'll take questions along the way or whenever you see fit. Governor Parnell, I believe when he released the budget in December, and I think you heard that last night in the State of the State address, is very optimistic about Alaska's future. Alaska's economy is growing, and we're providing opportunities for Alaskans. Some of the choices and decisions that were made in this body and have been supported by the governor have gone a long way to helping us put our financial house in order. We have solid financial footings, strong bond ratings, and the executive branch and the legislative branch, I think, are working very well together to sustain that energy as we move forward on the budget process. In developing the budget that's before you today, the governor set four principles that we used, living within our means. And when we talk about that, what does that mean? It's like all of us would do in our own household budgets. We have tools in our toolbox. We have our income, we have our savings, we have our cash, and we also have some opportunities on low-interest financing should we decide to go down that road. When income is down, you focus on priorities and you manage your reserves to cover what you need to get done. In focusing on our priorities, we look to what the Constitution of Alaska says, and we talk about education and resource development, public safety. And we'll talk more about those components of the budget before you. Fixing what we have, whether it's our roads, our airports, our schools, or our public buildings, we must maintain our existing infrastructure. And then finishing what we've started. As we all know, there's a number of very important projects in Alaska that we have started, and we need to continue to work towards completion of those projects. In building this budget, we've spent many months working with our state agencies, the university, to bring it before you. So these key principles were very important in that process. As you heard from Commissioner Rodell in explaining the revenue forecast, the production and price have a significant impact on the revenue stream for the state of Alaska. I'm not going to go through the forecast because I think we've talked about that, but that's the backdrop for developing our budget this year. As you know, the governor and the legislature worked very closely last year in setting a spending target and coming in with a budget last year that was over $1 billion less than the previous fiscal year. The budget request that we have before you again has reduced the pressure on the general fund budget by over $1 billion. With less revenue, we'll spend less. We ask the departments to carefully evaluate their core services and their programs and the people and resources that they have to get the job done without seeking additional funds in the budget. We're looking at ways to decrease our overhead, to be more efficient, and focusing on our priorities. We know that we are going to need to go into our savings account in the current year and the next fiscal year in order to balance the need to provide essential services and the revenue picture that we have in the short term. But again, we are very optimistic that we will see a turnaround in that production in the not-too-distant future. When we look at our reserve accounts, and I appreciated the presentation by Commissioner Rodell talking about the health of those savings accounts, the purpose of this slide is to show you really how our savings accounts have grown over a period of time. So you can see going back to 2002 all the way up to where we are today, we've grown from about a $2 billion savings account to $16 billion in savings. And what we've really seen is when we had high oil prices, we were able to put more money into savings. Maintaining these strong reserves and managing the use of the reserves have been key to our long-range fiscal plan that we produce on an annual basis. We can use these reserves wisely to address our future, our short-term budget dilemmas. But we can also use these budget reserves wisely and invest them differently, as we talked about with the draw from this constitutional budget reserve to help us with our pension unfunded liability. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I think that the Commissioner made a very good point about the investment earnings potential in the retirement trust funds and the ability to leverage. So we'll talk.
Mr. Chairman, you may answer this later on, but I'm wondering on your FY15 projected year-end balance of $11.3 billion, does that reflect in any way the three areas that the governor had discussed as his priorities this next year, the unfunded liability of $3 billion, is that taken out of this account? The anticipation of what we may be spending on the gas line, and the anticipation if the governor was successful in getting what he wanted accomplished in the area of education, if all of those were addressed to the governor's satisfaction, would we be at $11.3 billion, or what number would we be at with those three issues that he wanted to address to make Alaska strong?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman. This would reflect the transfer of the $3 billion from the constitutional budget reserve into the retirement trust funds. The two pieces that the governor spoke about last night, the gas line and the potential on the education funding package, are not yet incorporated into our December numbers. Those bills have not yet been introduced with the accompanying fiscal notes. So those will be adjustments to the overall, depending on where we end up at the end of the legislative session on spending. This chart would show you, though, implementing the governor's December 15 budget as proposed, what the impact on the draws would be. So you would end up at the with $11.3 billion approximately, still a very strong reserve amount at the end of fiscal year 15.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, and I can get the answer later, but on the issue of transferring the $3 billion to the ARM board and their current rate of return that may have been better than past years, one of the numbers or measurement tools that I will use is looking at their long-term rate of return, because that 8% rate of return, I believe we have to go back to a 30-year span to actually see that in real numbers going on. So looking in the rearview mirror 1 year is not going to suffice me in moving $3 billion over onto a management tool that has not seen that performance, and we don't see that unless we go back over the, as I understand it, the full 30 years.
That's a very good point, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Ms. Rayfield.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the next few slides are designed to just provide some context into the total budget that is all three budget bills combined. The total request, all funds, for fiscal year 15 is $12.4 billion. What this particular chart shows you is that our unrestricted general fund budget, the $5.64 billion, is just a little over 50% of the total budget. Federal funds at $3 billion are about 23%. The permanent fund component of our budget, which is for dividends and inflation proofing, is roughly 15%. Designated general funds, and by this I mean general fund program receipts, university receipts, those types of fees are about 7%, and other state funds are around 4%. What I'd like to highlight on this chart, and I will try to do this throughout the presentation, is that on other state funds, the transfer of the $3 billion from the constitutional budget reserve is a component of that line. What we're basically talking about doing is taking money out of one fund and putting it into another. So it nets out when you look at the fiscal summary, but I want to be clear that it's reflected in that particular component. And I think the next slide will help you visualize that a little better. This pie chart, John tells me this is the sleeper pie chart, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I won't. But what this is really designed to do, Mr. Chairman, is if you look at our $12.4 billion request, these are basically the categories of funding that we're proposing. I like to look at the left-hand side. It's a little bit more than the left-hand side where you see the red and pink slices of the pie. From my perspective, those are the areas of the budget that we consider more non-discretionary, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And then the blue slices of the pie are those that are more discretionary. So when people talk about reducing government spending, it really is focusing more on the blue areas of the pie. But if I could just take a moment and talk about some of the pieces without getting into a lot of details. The very top left, the dark slice, is the K-12 formula. This includes our school funding formula, and it is based on the current statutory student allocation of $5,680 per student. It includes transportation expenditures as well. As you all know, we are not only fully funding the current statutory entitlement, but we also forward fund education in our budget. This does include the additional $25 million that's technically outside of the school funding formula that we have included in the past several years for utility and energy-related costs. So the budget does include that. The next slice, other formula programs, just over $2 billion, is for the most part that is Medicaid, public assistance. That's where you see our power cost equalization funding, which is 100% funded out of the PCE fund in the 15 budget. So those are the other types of formula programs. Statewide appropriations, that's where you see visually on this chart the $3 billion going into the direct payment into the unfunded liability. Also included in statewide appropriations is the tax credit. It's $450 million that we're proposing or estimated to be. It includes our debt service payments, and it also includes community revenue sharing. And then the permanent fund, as I mentioned earlier, is inflation proofing and dividends. On the blue side of the chart, this is the more discretionary area. When we talk about our state agency operations budget, we're talking about the 14 state departments, the University of Alaska, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. So those two slices total $4.3 billion, all funds. But what we've shown in this chart is that $2.26 billion of that is unrestricted general fund. And frankly, that is where a lot of the attention gets focused during the session, is where are we spending our general funds. And I do have another chart that will talk about that a little bit. And the capital budget this year is proposed at $1.67 billion. As I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman, it's that the governor and the legislature have worked together very well on fiscal issues and fiscal discipline. And what this chart shows is that when we set that spending target last year, we reduced the general fund spend from fiscal year 13 by over $1 billion, and then you see the proposal in FY 15, $1.3 billion less. We recognize that there's going to be a downward pressure on general fund spending and reducing our state operating budget and our operating budgets in total over the next several years. Again, still remaining very optimistic about the potential shift in our production because of the changes that have been made. But we know there's going to be some difficult decisions to be made here in the next couple of years, and that's why we've brought forward, I think, a very responsible budget given the current revenue picture. And one thing I might add on this particular point, Mr. Chairman, is that over the past several years, we have had very healthy capital budgets. We know that there are still funds remaining from those previously appropriated projects that will be available to continue work on those efforts and to continue to boost the economy. So there are still some funds remaining to be spent from those prior budgets.
Ms. Rayfield, two things. The Senator Fairclough has to go to a meeting with some constituents that are here in town. She'll only be about 5 or 10 minutes. Do you have a number on the capital budget dollars that are on the street yet to be spent? You had that last year, and I don't know if you have it at this time.
Mr. Chairman, the numbers that I have, I'll give them to you, but they'll be updated because we do our annual CAS, a CASA report, currently Capital Authorization Status Report, I think is what that stands for, and we'll get you a new one. But based on the one that we prepared last spring, we have about $6 billion in funds that have not yet been spent, and we have about another $5 billion that are encumbered for projects that will be coming online. Okay. So there's still a lot of work out there that yet to be done. Some of that, not to get into the capital budget too much, but some of that, of course, is authorization, federal authorization for projects. So timing of when those federal funds come in and when those projects are actually in development, you know, planning, design, construction, that takes some time too. You know, so a lot of that federal authorization does take several years before it all gets spent.
So somewhere around $6 billion is a good number to be working
on. That was the amount last spring. Now we know there's going to be, when they update it, they'll update it through a date. It was mid-December, so we'll have a much more current status of those appropriations.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding, too, that some of the bonds haven't been sold yet, as far back as even 2008. I don't know. I was always under the impression that we had a five-year period that we had to use this capital money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, of course, the Department of Revenue would be much better to answer that question. I do know that there are some bond-funded projects that have not moved forward for several different reasons. And the Department of Transportation and Commerce are working with Revenue very closely on those to make sure that the projects that we can move forward, we get the bonds sold and out, and if they're hung up, how we can best address those.
And if I may, am I correct, there's a five-year window on when you can use the capital money?
Do we know that? Excuse me, can I ask Mr. Boucher?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, this is John Boucher. I'm not certain on the time frame. I do know there can be tax consequences because of the earnings that are. So the department is very carefully managing how they're rolling out the most recent bond issues based upon some of the issues that you've discussed, but I'm not certain on the time horizon.
Is that once they're sold? That's once they're sold.
Yeah.
If they have, I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think that's once they're sold, there are those time horizons. If they've not yet sold them, then they have some, but Revenue really would be the best person
okay.
to talk to.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had stated earlier that the unfunded liability was included in the drawdown of our reserve accounts, the $3 billion. But when you look at this spending chart, obviously it doesn't show the $3 billion as an expenditure in the $5.8 billion. So the number is going to, even though it's a one-time expenditure, would be in the neighborhood of $8.6 billion. And we still have large issues out there, the largest one being the gas line and, to a smaller extent, education. And I bring this up because when I go back to page five, I have concerns, and we need to look at, I think, as a committee, our savings account and the burn rate of that account. And we are in the second year where we're addressing that, and we need to make sure that the one area that I'm concerned about, which is energy costs, are addressed for all of Alaskans. And I don't know what the burn rate is here, and we don't look beyond FY15, but as a committee, I think we need to be cognizant that the balances are going to continue to decline, and we need to ensure that what we envision and what the governor envisions and what the people of Alaska envision, how those dollars be spent, we need to make those decisions, preliminary decisions, and look at that burn rate as a committee. And I think that is our fiduciary responsibility, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully we can do that as a committee.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Go ahead, Ms. Rayfield.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just clarify for Senator Hoffman on the slide on page 8, the proposal for the retirement unfunded liability is to take it out of the constitutional budget reserve. This slide is only referring to unrestricted general fund. So when you see that that transfer on the fiscal summary, it's going to it comes out of an other funds category. It's not hitting our unrestricted general fund. So that's why it's not part of this chart. We also are very concerned about the use of our savings accounts, and we've been annually preparing our 10-year plan in that, and it was released on December 12th. You'll see a couple of scenarios where we have either based on the current forecast, building in some potential midterm our mid-range production numbers, and then also looking at some different price indicators. What it really points to is we're in a position where we need and have been imposing fiscal discipline on our annual unrestricted general fund spend so that we can maximize and deliver public services and minimize the draw on reserves. It will be incumbent upon us to do that in order to maintain those reserves over time. So the next chart is basically the same presentation of the previous one, but this is on general funds only. And I think it's, again, important for people to understand of the $5.6 billion general funds we are proposing to spend in the next year's budget, what those categories of funding are. And using the same color scheme, I have on the left-hand side those red areas, which I view as a little bit more non-discretionary. So these are the formula programs, K-12 education, and Medicaid. And to Senator Hoffman's earlier point, the fiscal notes for an education package are not yet incorporated in these December numbers. But that would be on the formula side. The statewide appropriations, again, that's our debt service, our oil tax credits, and our revenue sharing. On the blue side of the chart, these are the areas where I believe that there will be a lot of discussion and scrutiny over the agency non-formula portions of the budget. So what I've done on this particular chart is taken, and remember we talked about our 14 state agencies, the university, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and I've broken into how much of that general fund is in our personal services budget. So you'll see up there agency personnel is about $1.45 billion of the $5.6 million. We have our other agency costs and the capital budget request of $426.3 million. So in our view, that probably is going to be the component of state agency spending that you and your subcommittees will be spending some time on in addition to discussions about the capital budget. The next slide would be where if we could just spend a little bit of time talking about what we've actually already spent some time talking about is the state assistant payment and the proposal that the governor is making to address this issue. I also had in your packet a handout which gives you a little bit more details, but we all know that the retirement unfunded liability is a very serious issue. It is the single largest cost driver we have in our operating budget, and if we don't address it, it will have a negative impact for future generations. We know also that the legislature, the governor, and the ARM board have been working very diligently on this issue, and over the past 7 years, we have paid over $3.3 billion in direct assistance payments to help address the unfunded liability, and this has been a huge relief to our municipalities and our school districts. So I think we have done a considerable amount in this regard, but the fact of the matter is we still have a significant, almost $12 billion unfunded liability. What you see on this chart in the black bars is the escalating cost of the assistance payments based on what the current methodology we've been using, the level percent of pay. So you'll see that annual payment increasing. And over the period of time to 2032, we will spend $15.2 billion. What the governor's proposing to do is in the blue bars, you'll see the $3 billion direct payment we're proposing to make in this fiscal year, and then capping the annual payment at $500 million. The result is it extends out 3 years beyond the current methodology, but it ends up costing us about $2 billion less. And our goals, I think, have been the same as all of your goals. We need to be able to manage the annual cost of the program. We need to meet our obligations to our retirees. We want to preserve the health of the trust funds, and we don't want to leave this to the next generation. So the proposal is, as we've talked about, to transfer the $3 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve with your approval, and that will immediately drop this annual payment down to $500 in the next year's budget. It will almost immediately increase the health of the funds by 10%. And I think that the commissioner made a point, which Senator Fairclough mentioned also, that you know, it may be a better investment of those dollars and earnings under the presenter's funds, but we need to look at that and see what that translates to over time. We understand there are several ideas about how best to tackle that, and so we look forward to the ongoing discussion with the committee on this, but we think and recognize it is a very important item.
Karen? Mm-hmm. If I may, just a couple questions on this. Can you explain why, I mean, if we agree that the $3 billion, if we should spend it, and in my mind we're spending it, because you're saying money coming out of the CBR spends like UGF. So actually, if we take $3 billion out of the CBR and put it in this trust, it actually, our spending goes up $3 billion. Am I missing something there?
Mr. Chairman, from our perspective, we're leveraging the use of our existing savings, and we're transferring it to the trust fund to get the maximum benefit of those funds that are already in our savings account. And what the result of that is it takes the pressure off our annual recurring revenue from our unrestricted general fund, so that next year, or as you look at the escalating cost of payments, if you've got $5 billion in revenue and $1 billion in education funding and a couple $1 billion in other funds, if you have $1 billion payment, there's going to be extraordinary pressure on being able to provide essential annual services. So by doing this better utilizing funds we already have in our savings account to address this problem to help us manage our costs over time. It will relieve the pressure that we're going to feel on the operating budget.
But I guess, and I don't want to split hairs with you, but I guess if the money from the CBR is considered general UGF money, and money that could be going towards roads, schools, education funding, et cetera, then we should count it as spending. And I guess the other question I have is, why do we have to put it in the trust? Why can't we just set aside a reserve account or an escrow account so that if we are overfunding this, then we can get access to that money? I mean, yeah, I'm concerned, too, about the next generation, but I don't want to leave them too much. That so that we don't have money to educate these kids so that there is a next generation.
Mr. Chairman, and you know, not to get terribly technical, but you are absolutely right. With a three-quarters vote of the legislature, you know, we can use the constitutional budget reserve for any particular item that the legislature might want or choose to do so. The governor is proposing a single item, either we do it for this or not. He's not wanting to suggest it for any other purpose. And we are showing it on our fiscal summary as a spend because we're taking it out of the CBR and we're going to make that direct payment. And you'll see that. It's not in the way that the budgeteers call it, unrestricted general fund. So it's not appearing in that column. That's the only distinction I would make there. But to your point about why not just put it in a reserve account instead of putting it into the trust fund. My understanding is that from the technical standpoint on the actuarial side, the actuaries will not consider that as a contribution to our unfunded liability. So they will continue to make their actuarial valuations of our health of our funds, not counting something that's in a reserve account. So the only way that's going to impact the health of the fund, and Mr. Boucher, please jump in here if I'm not saying this correctly, but the only way that we can actually impact the health of that fund is to take the money and put it into the trust funds.
And is the fund not healthy now? I mean, I thought we had AAA rating and everything was looking good. And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we do have a AAA rating, and I think one of the as we've heard across the country, rating agencies have looked very critically at states and cities who are not addressing their unfunded liability. The health of our unfunded liability in our trust funds, I think we're at 52% in TERS and 62% in PERS, or I might have just flipped those around. I think it's on the handout. Those are not considered to be particularly healthy funds. So by saying if we deposit $3 billion into that fund now and we can get almost a 10% bump in the health of those funds, that's significant. It would return it to almost where we were in 2003.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't want to dominate conversation on this, and we're going to have a lot more discussion on it. But It is true, though, here in Alaska, we account for the medical. We're one of only four states, I believe, nationwide, that accounts for the medical in their unfunded liability, which makes ours look much worse than other states as well.
That is absolutely correct. We are one of the four states that does include that. So that is part of how they calculate our unfunded liability.
Backed up the medical, the unfunded liability would be closer to, what, $7 billion? Seven or eight?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I don't know the metrics on that, but I understand that we cannot back it out because it is part of what we had committed to.
Senator Fairclough and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on Senator Meyer's questioning, as far as creating a sub-account and the actuaries actuarially not being recognized, it is true that we've already set up a payment method to pay off our unfunded liability. And as long as we meet those payments, that we will be viewed in good standing, per se, because we have a plan that is on the books. And so if the sub-account is doing the same thing as flattening our payments by that's a portion that we can draw the interest from to flatten the payments in a different way, the rating agencies would leave us whole.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fairclough, certainly I think that's an approach that's one of several approaches that have been considered.
Obviously, I think this is going to be a big question that we're going to answer before the end of the session. It is probably the biggest question, I think, as far as the operating budget is concerned. Senator Fairclough, follow up, and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I've said this to you before, Ms. Rayfield, but just so I restate it on the public record, one of the measurement tools that I will be looking at is what is left in the fund. So there are different goals. The ARM board is absolutely, as well as the legislature, responsible for the health of the people who have been promised benefits. And I plan to make sure that my votes are in line with that responsibility. And now I've just drawn a total blank on what I was going to ask you. Doggone it.
Well, you're grouping there. We'll go to Senator Hoffman. Is that all right?
Please, that's fine.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too believe that we need another look at this. You know, we've had proposals to put it into a reserve account, as Senator Meyer said, and Senator Fairclough, and there was opposition by the ARMS board to this approach because it didn't reflect what they felt was the true liability. But under that proposal, we would be looked at primarily as a loan, and we would get those funds back from a fiduciary responsibility. It seems as though that makes a lot more sense to me from a fiscal standpoint than an outright gift of $2 billion just to assure that the ARM board can reflect what they want to show as the unfunded liability. To us, we know the systems are closed, and at the end of the day, I would rather see those funds, even though it may be 30 years out or 35 years out, be reaped back to the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you. I wrote it down this time. what's left in the fund is my bottom line. So if we were to invest $3 billion today, the ARM board is trying to make sure that there are cash flow available to make their annual payments that our members, our beneficiaries, are asking for to support their health needs. And so if we run the numbers out, I'd like to know that with that $3 billion infusion, what it looks like. Because we look at how it drops off, well, we unfortunately, people are dying during that process. And so how many people are left to draw at the end of the day? And again, Senator Hoffman and I, as well as Senator Meyer and Senator Kelly, have been discussing what will it look like. Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, all of us have been talking about what's in the fund at the end, because the ARM board is absolutely trying to take care of today and look into the future, but we may have different goals if there's money left in the account at the end of the day. Whose money is that then? Is it the beneficiaries or is it the states, because we're contributing that? And if there's going to be an argument about whose assets those are, we want to have that argument or at least the discussion and debate about that today so that we actively know what we're doing with those funds. Thank you.
Ms. Rayfield, there has been a lot of conversation in this building over the past few months, or among the body over the past few months, and certainly in this building over the last few days, about just this question. And I would hope you would communicate to your boss that we really support a healthy retirement system, no question about it. I think, Senator Fairclough, if I could only characterize it just a little bit differently, and that I think we have the same goals in mind. We have different methods to get to the same goal. So if we could enter a discussion with your third floor about exactly how we do that, and we're going to come to it with an open mind. I've gotten that sense from everyone, and I would just encourage your people on the third floor to maybe engage with that same open mind, and let's have a good discussion.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Ms. Mary. Senator Bishop, did you have a question? I can't remember.
Just one quick comment along the same theme as the rest of my colleagues is the administration, the governor in particular, has some goals. It's going to take cash. And I know my colleagues and myself, we've got some goals and one of those is continuing to lower the cost of energy in Alaska, and especially rural Alaska, for us going forward. So I'm just of the persuasion to keep a strong cash position and still get to where we want to go.
Exactly. Ms. Rayfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in the interest of time, should I continue?
Go right ahead.
Thank you.
I think we're going to have to be held at about 11:30. Is that all right with you? Can you do that?
That's perfect. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to just highlight some things, because in addition to, clearly the unfunded liability was a big piece of our budget proposal because of shifting to this direct deposit from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. In addition to that, we've done several things in the budget that, as you look at not only the spending controls, can we shift to the next slide, that we have some various spending controls that we've implemented over the last 3 years that I know we've talked about. In addition to that, the governor's budget this year reduces 150 positions. That's about a $10 million cut to the budget. You'll see a number of reductions and specific reductions in agency budgets as a result. So I think your subcommittees will have a lot of questions about those when you get into the specifics. We made some reductions to the fuel trigger calculation of $6 million. We had about a $14.5 million shift from not restoring all of the one-time items in the budget. We reduced our working reserve rates. And so I think there will be a lot of conversation to have on the operating budget side in addition to the unfunded liability component. On the next slide, Mr. Chairman, we talked about our focuses on the constitutional priorities. Again, in your handouts, there's a one-page summary of some of the bigger pieces of the priorities that were included in the governor's budget on energy, specifically to Senator Bishop's questions. We do have some pieces on energy, resource development, education. I won't repeat all of those now, because we have talked about several of them, but there are specific pieces that I know you'll be interested in, the digital teaching initiative that the governor was talking about in education's budget. But we continue to do many of the things that under our fix what we have and finish what we started criteria. So that will be important for the committee to take a look at as well. And at the risk of one more pie chart, Mr. Chairman, I'm always trying to come up with a way to visualize why is this budget so important to Alaskans, and why is it important, and why do we spend so much time on it? And I think when I looked at it this way, to think about how much of our state budget goes out to Alaskans through their communities, individuals, or organizations, when you look at our total budget through grants and direct payments and our capital spend, it's almost 60% of our total budget. It's for things like, in that particular slice, it would be for things like our school funding, our capital budget, our Medicaid permanent fund dividend payments, school funding, named recipient grants. In the 24%, which I'm calling purchase services and investments, those are the types of purchases that we make to a lot of our private vendors for travel, hotels, professional services. So that also is important to communities around the state. And then about 19% are the salaries for the state employees that help provide the services to Alaskans on a daily basis. So I think this is just another way to show the significance of the debate that we have every year on the budget, and why it is so important, and why it takes so much time. And with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. And I know we'll spend some more time together.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Rayfield. You know, I've got to take off here at 11:30. I've got a meeting that I've got to go to. And Senator Hoffman has a question afterwards, so I'll make my comments, hand the gavel over to Senator Meyer, and then...
I have a meeting at 11:32, maybe.
Okay. Senator Fairclough. Okay, Senator Fairclough. I want to thank you for the work you do. I've been a part of the budget process when I worked with the university, in the internal budget process, obviously with the legislature. We have a different look at it. and I had the privilege of working with you when the first year I worked for the governor. And I know it's a lot of work. It's an incredible amount of work, and most of it falls right on your shoulders. You've done a really good job, and you always do a good job. You did a good job way back when you were with the Knowles administration, and you were the education administrative services director at that time, I think you were. My comment is this. It is rare for a governor to provide a budget to the legislature that has an actual reduction in it. Now, I think we could get into a discussion about what the reduction is because of some of the massive moves of movement of dollars that you've done, and I'm not going to characterize those as sleight of hand or smoking mirrors or anything like that. They were not. They're very transparent. But we see in the actual piece that most Alaskans consider government, we see a reduction in this budget. And I know that came at a great cost internally for you guys because there had to be, and last year we talked, there was over $1 billion worth of requests that you had to winnow through. I assume it was something similar this year, if not more. Anyway, I appreciate it. I think as the meeting that I have to go to is a meeting that I'm having with all the members of this caucus to get a sense of what they want from this budget, the operating budget specifically, more specifically the statewide agencies, the piece that Alaskans consider as government. So we may have a bit of a battle to still go. I know you've been through a lot in the last 6 months as you've been developing this budget, and the sense that I'm getting is that people maybe want to reduce it a little bit more. But that has yet to be determined. Obviously, the only thing that counts is our vote at the end of the day and what comes out of the conference committee. But at this point, I'm getting the sense that we may want to reduce that some more. But I don't want you to be mischaracterized by anyone as saying that you guys didn't do your job or that you're not fiscally responsible. Just because we maybe want to cut it some more doesn't mean that you didn't go through a huge process to get the cut that you do have. And I appreciate it, and I know members around this table do too, and so thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I very much appreciate your comments, and to the credit of our departments, because it has been an incredible amount of work. And as you mentioned earlier, in the past we generally have a whole lot more in requests from state departments than we put forward. That did not happen this year. We started back in May letting people know that this was going to be a very different budget cycle. They only brought things to us that were significant areas of problem or concern in their budget. And we do have an actual reduction in the agency operations portion of the budget. Now, on the statewide pieces, it's probably what you're referring to, where the unfunded liability payment because of our proposal or the shift in the tax credits, those are big picture pieces. But when you're really looking at the agency budget, we have a reduction in there, and our commissioners worked very hard to get to it. But they also know that next year is probably going to be more difficult than this year. So, I mean, everyone, I believe, is on the same page here, and it was an incredible amount of work, so I appreciate your comment.
Well, I think last year the budget that you gave us, which was a pretty decent budget as well, I think what it did, and we were able to kind of punctuate that, is that it put the brakes on this kind of default expansion of government every year. And we really, there was a reduction last year, but whatever, it wasn't significant. But it stopped the growth. And I think if we're going to get, as I said at a press conference, that most of the people in this building, or on the Senate side anyway, are talking about getting to some kind of a model that looks like Dr. Goldsmith's model, that we have to reduce to get there. And we have to reduce in state agencies to do it, which are the toughest cuts ever. And so we hit the brakes, and now maybe we got to put it in reverse and start backing it off a little. Any other comments? I've got to take off to a meeting. Senator Hoffman?
Just one quick comment, and you could answer it later. We know that the revenue sharing program is on a 3-year cycle to fill in, but with the declining revenues that we foresee, I wonder if you could give us health of that fund as projected by the department over the next, say, 9 years or 10 years, knowing that our revenues are going down. Are we looking at the demise of that program? So I just need a health report on the revenue sharing program. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any other comments from committee members? Thank you for joining us today. For those at home, thank you for coming on board, and thank you to everyone. With that, we're adjourned.